So, you're probably all aware of what it means when someone said, I've just had one of those days or those weeks. I feel like I've been having one of those months. We just got finished moving into a storage space, and my parents' house is where we're staying. We're not living in a storage space. Yeah, it's tight. So it's been kind of a crazy month. We've had to find subletters for our place. We bought a townhouse, but we don't get possession until September. And I've been going to work still every day, and we've been packing, and it's been crazy. It's finally kind of done. And then on top of all that, I had agreed to speak tonight, not realizing at the time what would be going on. Nobody wanted to switch with me, so here I am. So all that to say, I'm using an iPad with my stuff on it, not because I want to be a hip pastor who uses an iPad, because I'm not a pastor, but only because last night when we were staying at my parents, I said I went to go print my notes, and their printer was out of ink, and so this is what it came down to. So please forgive the pretension here. It's not intentional. Anyway, all right, so I'm going to start now. I'm just going to, the other thing is because it's been so crazy, prep's been hard. Mike Friesen last week suggested I just show videos, like a teacher who didn't prep. I think that's why teachers do video days, right?
Yeah.
But I decided I'm gonna read a bunch of stuff, and hopefully that'll work out. I don't know how much light I have, though. This might be tough. Oh, here we go. Okay. So I'm going to read some stuff. We're going to talk about it, try and tie it all together. But here's the first thing. It's from this guy named David Sedaris, and I think hopefully you'll get a laugh out of it. If not, you'll be really offended. This is called If I Ruled the World. If I ruled the world, the first thing I'd do is concede all power to the real king, who, in case you don't happen to know, is named Jesus Christ. A lot of people have managed to forget this lately, so the second thing I'll do is remind them of it. Not only will I bring back mandatory prayer in school, but I will also institute it at work. Then in skating rinks and airports. Wherever people live or do business, they shall know his name. Christ's picture will go on all of our money, and if you have checks with specially printed with sailboats or shamrocks on them too, well, that's too bad, because from here on out, the only images will be allowed will be of him. Or maybe of me reminding you of how important it is. T-shirts with crosses and apostles on them will be allowed, but none of this nonsense you see nowadays. This one my neighbor has, for example, certified sex instructor, it says. He claims he only wears it while mowing the lawn, but in the summer, that's once a week, which in my book is once a week too often. I mean, please, he's 72. Jesus and I are going to take that t-shirt and all the ones like it and use them as rags for washing people's mouths out. I normally don't believe in rough stuff, but what about those who simply refuse to learn? Look, I'll say to Jesus, enough is enough. I suggest we nail some boards together and have ourselves an old-fashioned crucifixion. It's bound to stir up a few bad memories, but having been gone for all that time, he probably won't know how bad things have gotten. Just turn on the radio, I'll tell him. It's that thing next to my ferret cage with all the knobs on it. Jesus will tune into our local so-called music station, and within 2 minutes he'll know what I'm talking about. Music's so rude it'll make his ears blister. And the TV. I turned mine on the other morning and came upon a man who used to be a woman. He had a little mustache and a pot belly and everything. Changed his name from Mary Louise to Vince and sat back with a satisfied smile on his face, figuring he'd licked the system. And maybe he did last year when they did the operation, but Jesus is the system now, and we'll have to hear what he has to say about it. The creature on TV, I can't say male or female without bringing on a stomachache, said that when he was a woman, he was attracted to men, and that he still is. This means that now, on top of everything else, it's a homosexual. And if we don't have enough already, some doctor had to go make one. This is supposed to be a joke, don't worry. Well, to hell with him, quite literally, and to hell with all the other gays too, and the abortionists, and the people who have had abortions even though they were raped, or the baby had three heads, and delivery was going to tear the mother to pieces. That was your baby, I'm going to say to Jesus. Now, are you just going to sit there and watch it get thrown out into some trash heap? And Jesus will say, no, Casey Hasselbeck, I am not. And he and I are going to work really well together. What's next on the agenda, he'll say, and I'll point him to the Muslims and vegans and who believe their God is the real one. Then the same goes for the Buddhists and whoever is that thinks cows and monkeys have special powers. And then we'll go out into the comedians with their F this and GD that. I'll crucify the Democrats, the communists, and a good 97% of college students. Don't laugh, Tim Cobblestone, because you're next. Think you can let your cat foul up my flower beds and get away with it? Well, think again. And Curtis Devlin, who turned down my application for a home improvement loan, and Carlotta Buffington, who only got her job because she's paralyzed on one side, and even my grandson, Kenny Bullock. He just turned 5, but no matter what Trisha says, this is not a phase. The child is evil, and it's best to stop him now before any real damage is done. And all the other evil people and whores and liars who want to take away our freedom and raise our taxes, they shall know our fury, Jesus and mine, and burn forever. David Sedaris is a satirist. He sometimes creates these characters and then runs with them. So he's not being serious, I hope. Because he's actually gay, so that would probably be a problem for him. But the point of satire is obviously to point out very sort of atrocious examples of something in order that we can kind of recognize how ridiculous it is and then start to recognize that in the real world. And the reason that I think this one is so kind of effective is because some of the stuff he says isn't that far away, I don't think, from other things that have been published in the past. You can think of sort of splintered church groups or sects that protest funerals and things like this, and it's just awful. And so he sort of points out how ridiculous it can get when you stand in for Jesus and decide that you know what's best and you're going to get him behind you and use him as an agent of hate and division. So what I really find interesting is the idea of sort of Jesus and Christianity as a conquering sort of army, because that's the idea that we're looking at here, is that in order for Jesus' work to be done, or God's work to be done in the world, he has to have complete control over our minds and the way things work and politics and everything else. And so this is kind of exploiting that idea that we need to conquer and then do away with everybody who disagrees with us. Unfortunately, it's not a very distant idea. I think there's quite a few songs that use war imagery. There's entire Christian traditions, sort of denominations. They're built around a war metaphor. And so it's unfortunately a very real thing in our world. Because it seems like we as Christians can't really get away from the idea that our faith is a fight. And our faith has it won, like it's got to win, until everyone is either on our side, or if they're not on our side, they're at least quiet and hidden away or dead. And we've seen this play out again and again throughout history. If you think about the Crusades or the Spanish Inquisition during the referendum, a lot of things that happened during colonialism and the Holocaust. We as humans keep having trouble sort of figuring out a way to keep our faith personal and sort of letting other people do the same. And I think that in a lot of ways it has to do with this passage that I want to deal with. Even though the passage is not saying this, it kind of works them together. The passage is from Matthew 5:5, which is the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. And it's from a section called Beatitudes. And I'm just going to read the one verse, because that's kind of all I want to deal with today, because it actually encompasses a lot. It says, "Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth." And so I have this feeling that there's been a lot of people over the years, over the last two millennia of Christianity, that have sort of looked at this passage and said, wait, the earth is up for grabs? Like, we can get it? The whole thing, I want that. And how do we go about getting it? Whatever, I'm just going to take it, because that's the way our human mentality works. And so they tend to drop the E and the K from meek, and blessed be the me, for I will inherit the earth. And they usually change inherit to conquer. And so they go about fantasizing about all the things that they would do. I say they, but we, everybody does this if they were really in charge, the same way David Sedaris' character does. You know, we begin to think about all those little things that bother us, like that neighbor who mows his lawn at 8 o'clock on a Saturday morning, or the lady down the hall who seems to have more boyfriends or girlfriends than we think they should. Sometimes we think about that jerk who never holds the elevator door, even though he saw me leave and heard me, I'm sure. Or that other guy with the obnoxious car with those rims that, like, spin, and some sort of weird lighting thing, and he's always playing his music really loud. You know, we think, if we could just get rid of those guys, Jesus obviously would hate those guys as much as I do, right? And then we'll be okay. And then I can be meek because everyone will agree with me and I can just get along with everyone. But I think that the reason that it's so hard to imagine a world where the shy and the quiet and the silently desperate are the ones who are going to be gifted, and I say gifted because one inherits through generosity, not through force, are going to be the ones that inherit the earth, is so hard to accept is because it really kind of does seem impossible in the world, the way things tend to play out. Generally, it's the strongest who survive, the loudest who are heard, the craftiest who tend to succeed, and the most devious who tend to prosper. And so it really becomes kind of a depressing idea if we let it. But that's why I'm not stopping here. And that's why I think this idea weighs on my mind so much. I tend to be a bit of an obsessive, and I think in terms of my thinking about Christianity, this has been an obsession for me for a few months. And so because of that, whenever I'm sort of reading different things and I find something that alludes to this idea of the meek, I tend to jump on it, underline it, and keep coming back to it because I like to think about what it's telling me. Because I'm definitely a person who struggles with both being meek and believing that being meek is worthwhile. So, got a couple books here, and I'm gonna read some passages from them. These are books that I've read, not all in the last few months, but over the last few years, and that have things that really stood out. And we're gonna try and tie them all together into this idea that Christ is talking about inheriting the earth, about the meek inheriting the earth. So the first one is called Lost Horizon. I'm not going to go too much into the history of each of these books, but it's written sometime in the 20s. It could kind of be on the borders of science fiction even, although I'd prefer to call it magic realism. If anyone's ever studied literature, they'll know what that means, but if not, don't worry about it. Essentially, it's about a bunch of people who they're trying to get out of China during a war, and their plane gets hijacked, and they get taken into the middle of the mountains, and they're going to die, but then these people show up and lead them to this valley where it's beautiful, and it's called Shangri-La, and it's this this monastery where people seem to live forever, and for some reason, even though it's in the middle of the mountains, it's warm and it's nice, and what's happening here is one of the guys who's on this trip gets to meet the High Lama, and they're having a conversation about this place, Shangri-La, that they're living in, and what it's doing there. The main guy's name is Conway. As Conway was silent for an interval, but then replied, "I was deeply impressed by your story of the past, but to be candid, your sketch of the future interests me only in an abstract sense. I can't look so far ahead. I should certainly be sorry if I had to leave Shangri-La tomorrow, or next week, or perhaps even next year. But how shall I feel about it if I live 100 years? I can face it like any other future, but in order to make me keen, it must have a point. I've sometimes doubted whether life itself has any, and if not, long life must be even more pointless. My friend, the traditions of this building, both Buddhist and Christian, are very reassuring. Maybe, but I'm afraid I still hanker after some more definite reason for envying the centurion." That's someone who's lived 100 years. There is a reason, and a very definite one indeed. It is the whole reason for this colony of chance-sought strangers living beyond their years. We do not follow an idle experiment, a mere whimsy. We have a dream and a vision. It is a vision that first appeared to old Perrault when he lay dying in this room in the year 1789. He looked back on his long life, as I've already told you, and it seemed to him that the loveliest things were transient and perishable, and that war, lust, and brutality might someday crush them, until there were no more left in the world. He remembered sights he had seen with his own eyes, and with his mind he pictured others. He saw the nations strengthening, not in wisdom, but in vulgar passions and the will to destroy. He saw their machine power multiplying until a single weapon man might match a whole army of the Grand Marquis. And he perceived that when they had filled the land and the sea with ruin, they would take to the air. Can you say that this vision was untrue? True indeed. And that was not all. He foresaw a time when men, exultant in the technique of homicide, would rage so hotly over the world that every precious thing would be in danger. Every book and picture, every harmony, every treasure garnered through two millenniums, the small, the delicate, the defenseless, all would be lost like the books of Livy, or wrecked as the English wrecked their summer palace in Peking. I share your opinion of that. Of course. But what are the opinions of reasonable men against iron and steel? Believe me, that vision of old Perrault will come true. And that, my son, is why I am here, and why you are here, and why we may pray to outlive the doom that gathers around on every side. To outlive it? There is a chance. It will all come to pass before you are as old as I am. And you think that Shangri-La will escape? Perhaps. We may expect no mercy. But we may faintly hope for neglect. Here we shall stay with our books and our music and our meditations, conserving the frail elegancies of a dying age, and seeking such wisdom as men will need when their passions are all spent. We have a heritage to cherish and bequeath. Let us take pleasure when we may until that time comes. And then? Then, my son, when the strong have devoured each other, the Christian ethic may at last be fulfilled, and the meek shall inherit the earth. So there's this monastic idea, this idea that you need to get away from the evils of the world, from the strong, from the bombastic, and that by doing so, and by pursuing the things that are good and beautiful and righteous, that you can somehow outlive the evil that will eventually destroy itself. It's this idea that we should stay separate and just kind of pray for neglect, and that we'll simply inherit whatever is left after everyone else is gone. And it's an interesting idea. It's clearly an idea that's been pursued a lot because monasteries and things like that have been around forever. And I think you can also see it when you look at Amish communities or some of these Mennonite communities where they separate themselves from everyone else and live in their own way, and they sort of block out the rest of the world in the hopes that they'll be able to stay righteous and pursue God and not get distracted by the things of the world. But it is an interesting idea, and sometimes it seems like a really good idea when you're really frustrated with the world, but I'm not sure that that's what Christ wanted. It's an interesting question. The other interesting question is who are the meek that he's speaking of in this case of this story? Are the meek the people? Are they the people that are living in this community? Is Christ talking about the literal meek people of the world? Or is he talking about the beautiful things of the world? The music, the stories, the paintings. Are these the small treasures, the vulnerable things of the earth that will survive to give hope to those that come later once the violence has taken over? We don't know that that's the course of history, how it goes. I think at the time that this book was written, in the 20s, you're in the sort of interwar period. You have a European writer who's seen the devastation of World War I, which the world had never seen before, and the very real possibility that millions of people did die in one war. And you also have sort of the beginnings fascism rising in Europe at the time. And so there's this idea that a leader could come and destroy the world or conquer the world, and that nothing would be safe anymore. And so I think that idea of getting away, of hiding away, comes very much out of that time. And I mean, of any time really, but anyway, it's something to think about in terms of the idea of the meek. I don't have to be the only one who talks, though. Does anyone have other ideas? I could be brave and open this up. Let me know. If you have an idea, put up your hand. Otherwise, I'm moving on to the next book. It's hot. Okay. This is the next book, To Kill a Mockingbird. Hopefully you've all read this. I wish everyone in the world would read this book. But anyway. This is a book about, it's told from the vantage point of a little girl who grew up in the South. It sort of tells of her whole life, kind of living in the South in the 1930s. The main thrust of the story has to do with her father is a lawyer who defends a black man who's been accused of raping a white woman. And essentially it comes very clear in the book that he had nothing to do with it, but that she was attracted to him and kissed him. And when that happened, her father saw and basically beat her to within an inch of her life. And because the father was so ashamed of her daughter being attracted to a black man, he made up the story. He made her tell the story that this man had raped her. The man's name is Tom Robinson. The father's name is Bob Ewell, just so you know when I'm talking about these people. The girl's name is Mayella. And the father, the lawyer's name, which you may recognize, his name's Atticus. Yes, that's where we got Addie's name from. And a lot of it came from this passage, because I think that there's something really beautiful about the way he conducts himself through the whole book, and it's really exemplified in this. And yeah, that's why we kind of went with this name. So anyway, that aside, here we go. Just right now, what's happened is that the trial is over. Tom Robinson has been convicted, even though it's clear that he's innocent. And so Bob Ewell comes up to Atticus in the street and confronts him because he didn't think he should have been defending. Well, basically because he made Bob Ewell a liar in front of the court. So I wish Bob Ewell wouldn't chew tobacco, was all Atticus said about it. According to Miss Stephanie Crawford, however, Atticus was leaving the post office when Mr. Ewell approached him, cursed him, spat on him, and threatened to kill him. Miss Stephanie, who by the time she had told it twice was there and had seen it all, passing by from the jitney jungle she was, Miss Stephanie said Atticus didn't bat an eye. He just took out his handkerchief and wiped his face and stood there and let Mr. Ewell call him names wild horses could not bring her to repeat. Mr. Ewell was a veteran of an obscure war. That plus Atticus' peaceful reaction probably prompted him to inquire. Too proud to fight, you nigger-loving bastard? Miss Stephanie said Atticus said, no, too old. Put his hands in his pockets and strolled on. Miss Stephanie said that you had to hand it to Atticus Finch. He could be right dry sometimes. Jem and I didn't think it was entertaining. Jem is her brother. After all, though, I said, he was the deadest shot in the county at one time. He could, you know, he wouldn't carry a gun, Scout. He ain't even got one, said Jim. You know he didn't even have one that night down at the jailhouse. He told me having a gun around is an invitation to somebody to shoot you. This is different, I said. We can ask him to borrow one. We did, he said, and he said nonsense. Dill was of the opinion that we should appeal to Atticus' better nature. After all, we would starve if Mr. Ewell killed him, besides being raised exclusively by Aunt Alexandria. And we all knew the first thing she'd do before Atticus was under the ground, good, would be to fire Calpurnia. Jem said it would work if I cried and flung a fit, being young and a girl. That didn't work either. But when he noticed us dragging around the neighborhood, not eating, taking little interest in normal pursuits, Atticus discovered how deeply frightened we were. He tempted Jem with a new football magazine one night, and when he saw Jem flipping the pages and tossing it aside, he said, what's bothering you, son? Jem came to the point. Mr. Ewell, what has happened? Nothing's happened. We're scared for you, and we think you ought to try to do something about him. Atticus smiled wryly. Do what? Put him under a peace bond? When a man says he's going to get you, looks like he means it. He meant it when he said it, said Atticus. Jim, see if you can stand in Bob Ewell's shoes for a minute. I destroyed his last shred of credibility at that trial, if he had any to begin with. The man had to have some kind of comeback. His kind always does. So if spitting in my face and threatening me save Mayella Ewell one extra beating, then that's something I'll gladly take. He had to take it out on somebody, and I'd rather it be me than the house full of children out there. You understand? Jem nodded. Aunt Alexandria entered the room as Atticus was saying, We don't have anything to fear from Bob Ewell. He got it all out of his system that morning. I wouldn't be so sure of that, Atticus, she said. His kind would do anything to pay off a grudge. You know how those people are. What on earth could a Ewell do to me, sister? Something furtive, Aunt Alexandria said. You may count on that. Nobody has a chance of being too furtive in Maycomb, Atticus answered. So here's a completely different sort of reaction to sort of injustice and evil in the world. Unlike sort of the monks in Lost Horizon, where they just decide they're going to separate and segregate from the whole world, find a little nice little paradise to live in and live out their days and hope that nobody notices. Atticus Finch faces evil head on. Throughout the story, obviously, he does it as a lawyer. He defends this man that everybody in the town says he shouldn't, and he goes against sort of the better judgment of people in the 30s in that town. And he uses the tool of justice to sort of fight against the evil that's going on. And then in this case, he does it again. And he uses this passive, sort of really meek way of confronting somebody, confronting Bob, by simply taking sort of the spit in his face, wiping it off, and turning around. And when he's challenged again, he makes a joke of it. He says, I'm just too old to fight. That's why I don't want to fight you. And in doing this, something weird happens because not only does Atticus look lower, he allows Bob Ewell to have the upper hand in the way that Bob Ewell didn't have to sacrifice any of his pride according to the traditions or sort of the way that things worked then. He made a challenge, and the person he challenged backed down. Atticus' role in sort of that society would have been to accept the challenge and fight back. And the idea is that if you don't think you're wrong, you should fight back. And if you don't fight back, then you must be wrong. And so Atticus completely flips this around and decides that he knows he's right. He knows that he's so right that he doesn't even have to fight to prove it. He can just move on. And in doing that, in upturning the tradition of the time, he manages to shame Bob, who is just playing into the conventions, and becomes the better man because he doesn't decide to meet violence with violence. Instead, he meets violence with peace. And so, because of that, Bob can go home feeling like he's satisfied, and he doesn't cause more violence to his daughter or the other children that are living there. And Atticus can take that shame on himself. I hope that makes sense. Kind of a long way around. But in a lot of ways, when we think about what Christ did on the cross, he did the same thing. He took the sin and the violence of the world, and he put it on himself and alleviated us from it and allowed us to become, to gain all everything from it by him losing everything.
So Tim, can I throw an idea out there?
Yeah.
I don't know if anyone else is making these connections. Maybe you already mentioned it, but for me it's just really a Trayvon Martin situation. Mm-hmm. I was reading up on it today and like looking at the comment boards and stuff, and Yeah, it's just I think it's really interesting and challenging for me to look at like in the story response to evil and comparing it to just that whole situation where I don't know what happened, but there was just some really different responses to feeling afraid and wanting justice.
Yeah.
On both the guy's part and wanting to be dead.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think what's really been amazing, I was just reading something today in the New York Times about the response. I mean, I think the police and everybody in Florida were expecting riots as if there was a not guilty that came down. And it came down not guilty. And these people have been crowded around courthouses and they've just been peacefully sitting there. There haven't been any riots yet. You know, hopefully there won't be. But it is an interesting response because it is the opposite of sort of human nature, which is, you know, that injustice has been done. I mean, whatever you think about how the trial went, I haven't read enough about it to really dig into it. But there's definitely people who feel like he should have been convicted. And now they're responding in a nonviolent way, which goes to put, does the same thing, right? It brings shame to those who think all these guys are just gonna, they're just gonna explode because they're animals. And so we have to be ready to bust some heads when they do, and they don't know how to respond to this. So, yeah, it's interesting. Thanks, Mike. Okay. Time's it. Time. This one's going to be a little bit longer of a read, so get comfortable. Maybe grab some more iced tea if you want. This one's going to be hard to read because it's small print. Yeah, that should help. Okay, this is, I'm going to throw some Russian literature at you. Don't worry, it's in English. This is Fyodor Dostoevsky's great, great novel, The Idiot. It's essentially about sort of an aristocrat who has some sort of mental disability. Doesn't really get into it. At times it seems like it might be Down syndrome. But obviously at the time this was written, there wasn't sort of distinctions for that sort of thing. But he's basically spent most of his life in an asylum. But not like a lockdown kind of asylum, but just somewhere he was trying to get help. His family had sent him. He's now come back to St. Petersburg, trying to fit into society again, but he's obviously quite different. The story I'm going to read is one that he's telling some of his cousins about his time that he spent in Switzerland in this asylum and the town that sort of surrounds this asylum. All right, get comfortable. The children disliked me. Disliked me at first. I was so big. I'm always so clumsy. I know I'm bad looking. Finally, there was the fact that I was a foreigner. The children looked at me at first, and then even began throwing stones at me. When they spied me kissing Marie, and I only kissed her once. No, don't laugh. Prince hastened to stop the smiles of his listeners. There wasn't any love there. If you knew what an unfortunate being she was, you'd pity her just as I did. She was from our village. Her mother was an old woman. And in her tiny, completely decrepit house, one of the two windows was partitioned off, with the permission of the village authorities, she was allowed to sell laces, thread, tobacco, and soap from this window, all at the lowest prices. And that was her subsistence. She was ill, her legs were swollen, and so she always sat in her place. Marie was her daughter, about 20, weak and thin. She had been consumptive for a long time. But she was growing. But she kept going from house to house, hiring herself out by the day to do heavy work, scrubbing floors, washing laundry, sweeping yards, tending cattle. A French traveling salesman seduced her and took her away. But after a week, he abandoned her on the road, and rode alone and quietly left. She came home begging on the way, all dirty, ragged, her shoes torn. She had walked for a week. Slept in the fields and caught a bad cold. Her feet were covered with sores, her hands swollen and chapped. She had never been pretty anyway. Only her eyes were gentle, kind, innocent. She was terribly taciturn. Once before then, she suddenly began to sing over her work, and I remember everybody was surprised and started laughing. Marie's begun to sing. What? Marie's begun to sing? And she was terribly abashed and kept silent forever after. People were still nice to her then. But when she came back sick and worn out. There was no compassion for her in anyone. How cruel they were about that. What harsh notions they have of it all. Her mother was the first to greet her with spite and contempt. You've dishonored me now. She was the first to hold her up to disgrace. And when they heard in the village that Maria had come back, everybody ran to look at her. And nearly the whole village came running to the old woman's cottage. Old men, children, women, girls, everybody. In such a hustling, greedy crowd. Maria was just lying on the floor at the old woman's feet, hungry, ragged, weeping. When they all rushed in, she covered herself with her disheveled hair and lay face down on the floor like that. Everybody looked at her as if she were vermin. The old men denounced and abused her. The young ones even laughed. And the women abused her, denounced her, looked on her with contempt, as if she was some sort of spider. Her mother allowed it all. She herself sat there nodding, her head and approving. Her mother was already very sick then, nearly dying. In fact, 2 months later, she did die. She knew that she was dying, but even so, she never thought of being reconciled with her daughter till her dying day. She never spoke a single word to her. Chased her out to sleep in the front hall and gave her almost nothing to eat. She often had to stroke her ailing legs with warm water. Marie washed her legs every day and took care of her. The woman accepted all of her services silently, and she never said a kind word to her. Marie endured it all, and later when I became acquainted with her, I noticed that she approved of it herself and considered herself the lowliest sort of creature. When the woman took to her bed, the old women of the village took turns looking after her as they do there. Then Marie was no longer even given anything to eat. Everybody in the village chased her away and nobody wanted to give her work as they used to. It was as if they all spat on her, and the men even stopped considering her a woman, such vile things they said to her. At times, very rarely, when they got drunk on Sundays, they amused themselves by tossing coins to her, like that, right on the ground. Marie silently picked them up. She had begun to cough up blood by then. Finally, her ragged clothes turned to real shreds, so that she was ashamed to show herself in the village. And she had gone barefoot ever since she had come back. It was then that the school children, the whole band, there were over 40 of them, began especially to mock her and even throw mud at her. And she asked the cowherd to let her tend their cows, but the cowherd chased her away. And she herself, without permission, began going with the herd the whole day away from the house. As she was very useful to the cowherd, he noticed it. He no longer chased her away, and sometimes he gave her the leftovers from his dinner, some cheese and bread. He considered it a charity on his part. When her mother died, the pastor saw no shame in disgracing Marie before all the people in the church. Marie stood behind the coffin, as she was, in her rags, and wept. Many people came to see how she would weep and walk behind the coffin. Then the pastor, he was still a young man, and his whole ambition was to become a great preacher, turned to them. He turned to them all and pointed at Marie. Here is the one who caused this respected woman's death, which wasn't true, because she had been sick for 2 years. Here she stands before you, and she dares not to look up, because she is marked by the finger of God. Here she is, barefoot and in rags, an example to those who lose their virtue. Here she is. She is her own daughter, and more in the same vein. And imagine, almost everyone there liked this meanness. But here, a peculiar thing occurred. Here the children stepped in, because by then the children were all on my side and begun to love Marie. This is how it happened. I wanted to do something for Marie. She needed money badly. I never had a penny while I was there. I had a small diamond pin, and I sold it to a certain peddler. He went from village to village trading clothes. He gave me 8 francs, though it was worth a good 40. I spent a long time trying to meet Marie alone. We finally met outside the village, by a hedge, on a side path to the mountain behind the tree. There I gave her the 8 francs, and I told her to be sparing of them, because I wouldn't have any more. Then I kissed her, and said she shouldn't think I had any bad intentions, but I kissed her not because I was in love with her, but because I felt very sorry for her. And from that very start, I had never regarded her as guilty, but only as unfortunate. I wanted very much to comfort her right then, and to assure her that she shouldn't regard herself as low before anyone. But she didn't seem to understand. I noticed it at once, though she was silent almost the whole while, and stood before me, looking down, terribly embarrassed. When I finished, she kissed my hand, and I took her hand once more and wanted to kiss it. But she quickly pulled it back. Just then, the children spied us, a whole crowd of them. I learned later that they had been spying on me for a long time. They began to whistle, clap their hands, and laugh, and Marie ran away. I wanted to speak to them, but they were throwing stones at me. That same day everybody knew about it, the entire village. It all fell on Marie again. They now disliked her still more. I even heard that they wanted to condemn her and punish her, but thank God it blew over. The children, however, wouldn't let her alone. Teased her worse than before, threw mud at her, and they chased her away. She ran away from them with her weak chest, gasping for breath, and they kept at it, shouting, abusing her. Once I even picked a fight with them. Then I started talking to them, talking every day, whenever I had a chance. They sometimes stood and listened, though they kept up their abuse. I told them how unfortunate Marie was. Soon they stopped abusing me and would silently walk away. We gradually began to talk. I didn't hide anything from them. I told them everything. They listened very curiously and soon started to feel sorry for Marie. Some started greeting her kindly when they met. The custom there, when you meet someone, whether you know them or not, was to bow and say good day. I can imagine how surprised Marie was. Once two girls got some food and brought it to her, gave it to her, and then came and told me. They said Marie burst into tears, and now they loved her very much. Soon they all began to love her, and at the same time they began to love me as well. They started coming to see me often, asking me to tell them stories. It seems I did it well, because they liked to listen to me very much. And later I studied and read everything only so as to tell them afterwards. And for 3 years after that I told them all sorts of stories. When everybody accused me afterwards, Schneider too, of talking to them like grown-ups without hiding anything, I replied that it was shameful to lie to them. They knew everything anyway, no matter how you hid it. They might learn it in a bad way. Well, for me, it wouldn't be in a bad way. You only had to remember yourself as a child. They didn't agree. I kissed Marie 2 weeks before her mother died. When the pastor gave his sermon, all the children were already on my side. I told them about it at once and explained the pastor's action. They all became angry with him, so much that they sent stones through the pastor's windows. I stopped them because it was a bad thing. But everyone in the village learned about it all at once. And they began to accuse me of having corrupted the children. Then they found out that the children loved Marie and became terribly frightened. But Marie was happy now. The children were even forbidden to meet her. But they ran in secret to see her with her herd, quite far, almost half a mile from the village. They brought her treats, and some would simply ran to her and embraced her and kissed her, saying, "Je vous aime, Marie." Then rushed headlong home. Marie lost her mind from this sudden happiness, almost lost her mind. She had never dreamed of anything like it. She was embarrassed and joyful, and the children, especially the girls, wanted above all to run to her and tell her that I loved her and that I had told them all about her. They told her that they knew everything from me, and that now they loved and pitied her and always would. Then they came running to me, and with such joyful, concerned little faces, they told me that they had just seen Marie and that Marie sent her greetings. In the evenings, I used to go to the waterfall. There was a place completely screened off from the village side with poplars growing around it. That was where they would gather with me every evening, even in secret. It seemed that my love for Marie delighted them terribly, and that that was the one thing during all my life there in which I deceived them. I didn't disappoint them by confessing that I did not love Marie at all, that I was not in love with her, but only pitied her. Everything told me that they preferred it the way they had imagined it and decided it among themselves. So I said nothing and pretended that they had guessed right. And those little hearts were so delicate and tender. Among other things, it seemed impossible to tell them that their good Leon, that's the guy who's speaking, should love Marie so much. While Marie was so poorly dressed and had no shoes. Imagine they even got shoes and stockings and linens for her, and even some sort of dress. How they managed it, I don't know. The whole band worked on it. When I asked them, they only laughed merrily. and the little girls clapped their hands and kissed me. I, too, occasionally went in secret to see Marie. She was becoming very ill and could barely walk. And in the end, she stopped helping the cow herd altogether. But even so, she left with the herd each morning. She sat to one side. There was a sheer, almost vertical cliff with a ledge. She would sit alone in the corner that was shielded from everyone and spend the whole day almost without moving from morning till it was time for the herd to go by. By then, she was so weak from consumption that she almost sat with her eyes closed, leaning her head against the rock and dozed, breathing heavily. Her face was thin as a skeleton's, and sweat stood out on her forehead and temples. This was the way I found her. I'd come for a minute, and I also didn't want to be seen. And as soon as I appeared, Marie would give a start, open her eyes, and rush to kiss my hands. I no longer withdrew them, because for her it was happiness. All the while I sat there, she trembled and wept, true. She tried several times to speak, but it was hard to understand her. She was like a crazy person, in a terrible agitation and rapture. Sometimes the children came with me. On those occasions, they usually stood not far away and set about guarding us from something or someone. And they were extraordinarily pleased with that. When we left, Marie again remained alone, motionless as before, her eyes closed and her head leaning against the rocks. She may have been dreaming of something. One morning, she was unable to go with the herd and stayed in her empty house. The children learned at once, and almost all of them went to visit her that day. She lay in her bed alone. For 2 days, only the children looked after her, taking turns and coming. But afterwards, when they learned in the village that Marie was really dying, the old women of the village began coming in turns to sit by her bedside. It seemed they started to feel sorry for Marie in the village. At least they no longer stopped or scolded the children as before. Marie dozed all the time. Her sleep was restless. She coughed terribly. The old woman chased the children away, but they came to the window, sometimes just for a moment, only to say, "Bonjour, notre bonne Marie." And as soon as she saw or heard them, she would become all animated, and not listening to the old woman would at once try to prop herself up on her elbow, nod to them, and thank them. They went on bringing treats, but she ate almost nothing. Because of them, I can assure you, she died almost happy. Because of them, she forgot her black woe, as if she had received forgiveness from them. Because till the very end, she considered herself a great criminal. Like little birds, they fluttered with their wings against the window and called to her every morning. She died very soon. I thought she would live much longer. On the eve of her death, before sunset, I stopped to see her. She seemed to recognize me, and I pressed her hand for the last time. How emaciated her hand was. Then suddenly in the morning, they come and tell me that Marie is dead. Here there was no holding the children back. They decorated the whole coffin with flowers and put a wreath on her head. In church, this time the pastor did not heap shame on the dead girl. And anyway, there were very few people at the funeral, only some who came out of curiosity. But when it was time to carry the coffin, the children all rushed to do it themselves. As they couldn't really carry it, they helped and ran after the coffin, all of them crying. Since then, Marie's little grave has been constantly venerated by the children. Every year, they decorate it with flowers, and they planted roses all around it. Perhaps that the problem that we have with trying to understand what it means to inherit the earth has a lot to do with the way we're looking at the question. When we think about these three characters that we've just read about, in contrast to that satirical one that I started with, we see, amongst other things, a serious lack of ambition and, most importantly, self-interest. The character in Sedaris' work wants to rule the world in order to make sure that his preferences are being met. He wants the rest of the world to change so that his morality can be satisfied. But the other characters are after something far different. The High Lama of Lost Horizon wants to ensure that the desolate future he predicts will still retain some beautiful things that humanity has created, even amidst the destruction that humans are much better at. And in that way, there can remain some faint glimmer of hope for those that are left when all the violent men and women have killed each other. Atticus Finch dreams of a world where people of all races and stations in life can coexist and can love or hate each other based on who they are rather than on skin color or social standing. He sacrifices his own reputation in order to keep from shaming Bob Yule. Atticus is clearly the more noble man. He's justified in his position, and he's thought of highly in his community, and yet he allows himself to be spit on by a man whose lies lead to the death of another man while he continues to beat his children and starve them through his laziness. Neither of these men are seeking to inherit the earth, and perhaps that's what makes a person truly meek. The hope that self-sacrifice will lead to the betterment of someone or possibly everyone. We too often think of the idea of inheriting the earth as a moment of glory, that one day God, or preferably our community, will notice how long we've been suffering and will exalt us, praise us, and give us what we deserve. But the more I dig into this idea of being meek, the more I realize that no one who is truly seeking the betterment of others is simultaneously looking for glory. When we put the happiness of others before our own, we find the satisfaction we've been looking for in their happiness. In The Idiot, Prince Mishkin, the guy who's telling the story, gained nothing from his charity towards Marie. If I had read on to the next paragraph, we're told that the community tells him to leave because they don't like what he's doing with the children. But Marie gained everything from what he did. And because Mishkin's only desire was for her to find joy, he gained everything he wanted. And therefore, he inherited the earth that he was after.